August this year.
This year? He's come back?
Yeah, just a few sessions now and then.
What was he doing here? Do you know, Lenny?
That's enough questions. It's all confidential. But you don't need to be a genius to guess. We don't monitor sites visited. Best not to, we decided. But basically, our members come to view adult sites.
Sorry to be blunt, but you mean porn?
He nodded.
Weren't you tempted to look to see after you realized it was him?
It was months after he stopped coming in that I realized it was him, and he'd used different computers. It would have been a big job, and we're busy.
Why didn't you call the police about Glenn Taylor?
Lenny looked away for a moment. I thought about it. But would you invite the police in here? People come because it's private. It would have closed the business. Anyway, they arrested him, so I didn't need to.
A loud knock on the shop door ended the conversation.
You've got to go. Got a customer.
Okay, thanks for telling me all this. Here's my card in case you think of anything else. Can I use your loo quickly before I go?
Lenny pointed at a door in the corner of the room. It's pretty grim, but help yourself.
He left her to it, and as soon as he'd gone, she pulled out her phone and photographed the membership card still sitting on the desk before pulling open the toilet door, holding her breath, and flushing the toilet. Lenny was waiting for her. He opened the front door and stood to shield the cowering customer from Kate's inquiring look. In the street, she phoned Bob Sparks.
Bob, it's Kate.
I think he's at it again.
Chapter 36. The Detective. Friday, December 18th, 2009. Sparks listened in silence as Kate told her story, casually noting the address and names, but unable to comment or question. Beside him, his new boss worked on, crunching numbers of street robbery victims by gender, age, and race. "Okay," he said when Kate drew a breath. "Bit busy at the moment. Can you send me the document you mentioned? Perhaps we could meet tomorrow." Kate understood the professional code. 10 a.m. outside the pub at the end of the road, Bob. I'm emailing you the photo I took now." He returned to his computer screen, miming regret for the interruption to his colleague, and waited until they had finished their work to look at his phone. Sparks felt sick as he looked at the membership card. Taylor's last visit was only 3 weeks earlier. He called Zara Salmond as he walked to the tube station.
"Sir, how are you doing?"
"Fine, Salmon. We need to go back to the case." He didn't need to say which. "We've got to look at every detail again to find a way to nail him."
"Right. Okay. Can you tell me why?"
He could imagine the look on his sergeant's face. "Difficult at the moment, Salmon, but I've had information that he's back on the porn trail again. Can't say more than that, but I'll be in touch when I've got more."
Salmon sighed.
He could hear her thought bubble, "not again," and couldn't blame her.
"I'm off for Christmas, sir, on leave, but back in on January the 2nd. Can it wait until then?"
"Yes. Sorry to ring out of the blue, Salmon. And happy Christmas." He put his phone in his overcoat pocket and trudged down the steps, his stomach knotted. The force had scaled back the Bella Elliott case after the lengthy Downing review found no new leads, no van, and no further suspects. D.I. Jude Downing had tidied her desk and gone back to her real job, and the Hampshire Police Force put out a press release saying that the investigation would continue. In reality, this meant leaving it ticking over with a team of two to check out the now occasional calls about possible sightings and pass them on. Nobody was saying it in public, but the trail had gone dead. Even the appetite for Dawn Elliott's emotional campaign was beginning to wane. There were only so many ways you could say, "I want my daughter back," Sparks supposed. And the Herald had gone very quiet on the subject
after its initial firestorm of publicity. And when Sparks went, it had removed the daily impetus for their hunt. DCI Wellington had also made sure Salmon was too busy with other work to take it up on her own initiative. She'd heard when Sparks was brought back from sick leave, but he'd still not set foot in the office. But his call before Christmas had stirred up all sorts of feelings. The day Salmon went back to work in January, she pulled up her own Bella case file, filled with the loose ends and tasks, and made a list while she waited for his call. Leafing through, she found the query on Matt White, unfinished business. She'd put it under priorities originally, but had been sidetracked by Sparks's latest idea. Not this time. She would chase it down and went online to search the electoral register for the name. Dozens of Matthew Whites, but nothing immediately matching Dawn's information about age, marital status, and area. She missed Sparks's dry humor and determination more than she'd admit to her colleagues. "Can't get sentimental if I'm to get anywhere in the police," she told Sparks. She needed to find Mr. White's true identity and went back to the basic information about Dawn's relationship with him. It took place largely in the Tropicana nightclub and, once, in a hotel room. "Where would he have had to use his real name, Zara?" she said out loud. "When he used his credit card," she finally answered. "I bet he paid by card at the hotel where he took Dawn." The hotel was part of a chain, and Salmon mentally crossed her fingers as she dialed its number to ask if they still had records from around the dates Dawn was seeing him. 5 days later, Salmon had another list. The hotel manager was a woman in the same efficient mold as the detective and had emailed the relevant data. "Matt White is here, sir," she said confidently to Sparks in a first brief phone call, and didn't speak for the rest of the day. Sparks put down his phone and allowed himself a moment to examine the possibilities. His new boss was an impatient man, and he had a paper to finish on the impact of ethnicity and gender on community policing efficiency, whatever that meant. The last 5 months had been surreal. As instructed by his superior officer and advised by his union rep, he'd contacted one of the counselors on the list and spent 60 grueling minutes with an overweight and underqualified woman who was all about tackling demons. "They are sitting on your shoulder, Bob. Can you feel them?" she said earnestly, sounding more like a psychic on the Blackpool Pier than a professional. He'd listened to her politely, but decided she seemed to have more demons than he did, and never went back. Eileen would have to do. His leave was extended piecemeal, and as he waited to be recalled to duty, he played with the idea of signing up for an open university course in psychology, printed out the reading list, and began his studies quietly in his dining room. When the recall finally came, he was to be sent zigzagging across a series of short-term assignments to other forces, plugging gaps and writing reports, while Hampshire worked out what to do with him. He was still seen as damaged goods, as far as the murder investigation unit was concerned, but he wasn't ready to retire on a pension, as they hoped. He couldn't leave yet. Things still to do. It took Salmon a week to work through the dates and patterns of names, listing and relisting as she checked with electoral registers, police computer records, Facebook, and social media to track down the guests. She loved this sort of work, the chase through data, knowing that if the information was there, she would find it and experience the moment of triumph when the name emerged. It was a Thursday afternoon when she found him. Mr. Matthew Evans, a married man living with his wife, Shan, in Walsall, and in Southampton on Dawn's dates. Right age, right job. She immediately went back to the helpful manager to ask her to put the name back through their system to see if he'd been in the city on the day Bella went missing. "No, no Matthew Evans since July 2003. He stayed one night in a deluxe double and had room service, the manager reported. Brilliant, thanks, she said, already texting Sparks with the news from her personal phone. She took a breath and walked up the stairs to the DCI's office to tell her about the new lead. She'd barely registered her before, except as part of the Bob Sparks problem. But that was about to change. Zara Salmond would be on the map. But if she'd expected a ticker tape parade, she was mistaken. Wellington listened carefully, then muttered,
Good work, Sergeant. Write your report and get it to me immediately. And let's send West Midlands around to see this Evans.
Salmond walked back to her office, her disappointed feet heavy on the stairs. Chapter 37 The Detective Saturday, January 16th, 2010 Matthew Evans was not a happy man. The police had come knocking on his door without warning, and his wife, baby on hip and toddler at her side, had opened the door to them. Bob Sparks smiled politely with Salmond standing nervously at his side. The young officer had agreed to go with her old boss to knock on the door, but knew she was putting herself on the line. She would have the book thrown at her if her superiors found out. But he'd persuaded her that they were doing the right thing.
I know I'm not on the case now.
You were removed, sir.
Right. Thank you for reminding me, Salmond. But I need to be there. I know the case inside out, and I'll be able to spot the lies, he'd said.
She knew he was right, and called the West Midlands police to let them know she'd be in their force area. But as soon as she put the phone down, she felt pressurized and sick. Salmond drove, but Sparks took the train north to avoid being seen by his former colleagues. When he spotted Salmond waiting for him outside the railway station, she looked grim and stressed.
Come on, Salmond. It'll be fine, he said quietly. No one will know I was here. The Invisible Man, I promise.
She'd given him a brave smile, and the pair trudged off to meet Matt Evans.
Matt, there's two police officers here to see you, his wife had called to him. What's this about?
She asked the officers on the doorstep. But Sparks and Salmond waited until they had her husband in front of them before saying anything further.
Fair's fair, Sparks thought.
Evans had a good idea why the police were there. The first time he saw Dawn and Bella on the television and did the math, he knew the cops would appear one day. But as the weeks, months, and now years passed, he began to hope.
She might not be mine, he told himself at the start. Bet Dawn was sleeping with other blokes.
But in his stomach, a much more reliable organ than his heart, he knew she was his. Bella looked so much like his real daughter. He was amazed people hadn't seen it and rung in to Crime Watch. But they hadn't, and he'd continued his life, adding to his family and picking up new Dawns along the way. He never had sex without a condom again, though. The senior officer suggested a quiet chat, and he gratefully took them into the dining room they never used.
Mr. Evans, do you know a Dawn Elliot? Salmond said.
Evans had considered lying. He was very good at it, but knew Dawn would identify him if it came to it.
Yes, we had a bit of a romance a few years ago, when I was working as a salesman down on the South Coast. You know what it's like when you're working long hours. You need a bit of fun, a bit of relaxation.
Salmond looked at him coolly, registering the floppy fringe, big brown eyes, and cheeky, persuasive smile. And moved on.
And did you know that Dawn had a baby after your romance?
Did she contact you? Evan swallowed hard.
No, I knew nothing about the baby. Look, I changed my mobile number because she was getting a bit clingy and...
You didn't want your wife to find out?
Sparks finished for him. Mac looked grateful and turned on the man-to-man stuff.
Yeah.
Look, Shan, my wife, doesn't need to know about this, does she?
The last time Shan Evans had been contacted by one of her husband's conquests, she'd said there would be no more chances and demanded that they have another baby, their third.
It'll bring us closer, Matt.
It hadn't. The sleepless nights and postpartum sex moratorium had sent him out looking for fun and relaxation again. There was a secretary in London at the moment. He couldn't help himself.
That's up to you, sir, Spark said. Has there ever been any contact between you since you changed your mobile?
No. I steered well clear.
Dangerous to go back. They think you've come back to marry them. Heartless bastard, Zara Salmon thought, writing HB in the margin of her notebook, then amending it to FHB. She'd had her own teenage encounters with married men on the prowl. Evans was fidgeting in his hard chair.
Actually, funny thing, I did spot her once in a chat room on the internet. I was just browsing through, like you do, and there she was. Seemed to remember she was Little Miss Sunshine, like the children's book. My eldest has got that one. But she was using her own photo. Not the brightest spark, Dawn.
Did you make yourself known to Little Miss Sunshine?
Course not. The whole point of chat rooms is everyone is supposed to be anonymous. More fun that way.
D.S. Salmon wrote it all down, asking him to spell out the name of the chat rooms he favoured and his own online identities. After 25 minutes, Evans began to rise to show them out, but Sparks had not finished.
We need you to give some samples, Mr. Evans.
What for? I'm pretty sure Bella was mine. She looks just like my other kids.
Well, that's good to know, but we need to be sure, and we need to be able to rule you out of our investigation.
Evans looked aghast.
Investigation? I haven't had anything to do with the disappearance of that little girl.
Your little girl, sir.
Well, yes, okay, but why would I kidnap a child? I've got three of my own.
Some days I'd pay someone to kidnap them. I'm sure, sir, Spark said. But we need to be thorough so we can rule you out. Why don't you get your jacket and tell your wife you need to go out?
The officers waited outside. Salmon looked like she might burst. She was so pleased with herself.
He saw Dawn in an over-18s chat room. She was a player. An amateur, but a player.
Sparks tried to remain calm, but the adrenaline was pumping through him too.
This could be the link, Salmon. The link between her and Glenn Taylor.
He laughed, despite himself. Neither of them heard the exchange between husband and wife, but Salmon sensed it was unfinished business when Evans got in the car with them.
Let's get this over with, he said, and shut up.
At the local police station, Evans gave DNA samples, attempting laddish banter with the younger officers, but no one was charmed.
Tougher audience than the wasted girls on the dance floor, Sparks thought, as Salmon applied a little more force than was strictly necessary on Evans's fingers in the ink.
Sorry, sir. You have to press hard to get a good impression.
Zara Salmon told Spark she was driving back to her HQ to tell her new boss the news, face to face. She needed time to put together her story without dropping Sparks and herself in it.
I'll say West Midlands didn't have the resources, so I went and confirmed that he's Bella Elliott's father, that he's a serial shagger from Brum like we thought, one Matthew Evans. Pharmaceutical company rep, married with three children. What do you think?
He'd smiled encouragement, adding,
And he may provide the link between Glenn and Bella. Cue champagne corks, Sparks thought, more in hope than in expectation.
In the end, she told him later, the significance of the breakthrough swept aside questions about why she had taken it upon herself to visit Evans herself.
We'll talk about that later, Salmon,
DCI Wellington said as she picked up the phone to Chief Superintendent Parker to claim her part of the glory. Sparks's recall to the Hampshire squad came 4 days later. C.S. Parker was short and to the point.
"We've got a fresh lead on the Bella case, Bob. No doubt you've heard. We want you to take it on. I'll talk to the Met to clear it. How quickly can you come back?"
"On my way, sir."
His return was typically low-key.
"Hello, Salmon. Let's see where we are with Matthew Evans," he said as he took his coat off.
And he slipped back in as if he'd stepped out for just a few minutes. Salmon and the IT forensics team did not have encouraging news. They had gone steaming back through the data downloaded from Taylor's original computer to hook out LMS as soon as they got the information. But she wasn't there.
"No chats, no emails, sir. We've looked under all the permutations, but she doesn't seem to figure."
Sparks, Salmon, and DC Dan Fry, who had been brought back into the team, stood in a ragged semicircle behind the techie's chair and stared at the screen as names rolled up, willing her to appear. It was the fourth time through the list, and the mood in the room was bleak. Sparks went back to his office and picked up the phone.
"Hello, Dawn. It's Bob Sparks. No, no news exactly. But I have a couple of questions. I need to talk to you, Dawn. Can I come now?"
She deserved to be handled carefully after all she'd been through, but this had to be addressed head on.
Chapter 38. The Mother. Thursday, July 13th, 2006. Dawn Elliott liked going out. She loved the ritual of a deep perfumed bath, conditioning and blow-drying her long hair in front of the mirror, putting on thick mascara with party music playing loudly, the final look in the full-length mirror on the wardrobe door, and then clip-clopping to the taxi in high heels, the fizz of excitement rising in her chest. Going out felt like being 17 forever. Bella had stopped all that for a while. It had been bloody stupid getting pregnant, and it was her own fault. Too eager to please. He was so sexy, dancing to be close to her that first time they set eyes on each other. He'd taken her hand and twirled her around until she was dizzy and laughing. They'd taken their drinks outside with the smokers to get some air. His name was Matt, and he was already taken, but she didn't care. He visited Southampton only once a month for work, but he phoned and texted every day in the beginning, when his wife thought he was fetching something from the car or taking the dog for a walk. It had lasted 6 months, until he told her his office had moved him from the south coast to the northeast. Their last encounter had been so intense, she felt drunk on the experience afterward. He'd begged her to have sex without a condom. "It'll be more special, Dawn." And it was, she supposed. But he didn't hang around to hear the result. Married men don't, her mother had told her, despairing of her naivete. "They've got wives and children, Dawn. They just want sex with stupid girls like you. What are you going to do about the baby?" She didn't know at first, and she put off any decision in case Matt reappeared, like a knight on a white horse to whisk her away to a new life. And when he didn't, she read glossy baby magazines and sleepwalked into motherhood. She didn't regret going ahead with the pregnancy. Well, not often. Only when Bella woke up every hour from 3 a.m., or was teething and screaming, or filling a nappy. The baby years turned out to be not as advertised in the magazines, but they had survived it together, and things got better as Bella became a person and a bit of company for Dawn. She'd tell her daughter all her secrets and thoughts, safe in the knowledge that Bella wouldn't judge her. The little girl laughed along with her when she was happy, and cuddled into her lap when Dawn cried. The hours spent watching CBeebies and playing video games on her phone didn't fill her life. Dawn was lonely. She was only 26. She shouldn't be on her own. But who would be interested in a single mum? She was attracted to married men. She'd read somewhere the older man represented a father figure and the excitement of forbidden fruit. She hadn't got the biblical illusion, but understood the mixture of danger and safety all too well. She wanted to find another Matt, but couldn't afford babysitters, and her mum disapproved of her going out until late. "What are you doing? Nightclubs? For goodness sake, Dawn. Look where that got you last time. You are a mother now. Why don't you go out for a meal with one of your friends?" So she did. She and Carol, an old school friend. Sharing a Hawaiian pizza was nice, but she didn't return home buzzing with music and vodka shots. She'd found the chat room through a magazine in the doctor's waiting room. Bella had a temperature and a rash, and Dawn knew that Dr. John, as he liked to be known, would chat with her, give her some attention. "Fancies me a bit," she told herself, deciding to put on makeup at the last minute. She needed to be fancied. Every woman did. Flipping through the pages of a teen mag, grimy with dozens of fingers and thumbs, she had read about the new dating scene online. She was so engrossed, she missed her number being called. The receptionist had to shout her name, and she got up quickly, grabbing Bella from the Lego pit and stuffing the magazine into her bag for later. Her laptop was old and battered, not helped by the fact that she kept it on top of the wardrobe, away from Bella's sticky fingers. A bloke at work had given it to her when he got a new one. She'd used it at first, but when the charger stopped working and she didn't have the money to get another one, she'd lost interest. On the way home from the doctor's, she used her emergency credit card to buy a new charger. The chat room was brilliant. She basked in the attention from her new friends, the men who wanted to know all about her, who asked about her life, her dreams, and wanted her photo, who weren't put off by her having a child. Some even wanted to know about her little girl. She didn't tell anyone else. No one outside the laptop. This was her thing.
Chapter 39. The Detective. Thursday, January 21st, 2010. The house on Manor Road looked cleaner and tidier. Bella's toys were stacked in a box by the television, and the front room had been turned into the Find Bella campaign headquarters. Volunteers were at a table going through the post. "We get 100 letters on a good day," Dawn said proudly, and sorting them into three piles: possible sightings, well-wishers, and nutters. The nutters pile looked a lot bigger than the others, but Sparks didn't comment. "Lots of people are sending money to help us look for Bella," Dawn said. The fund was putting adverts in newspapers all over the world, and paying for the occasional private investigator to check out a lead. "Let's go somewhere quiet, Dawn," he said, and guided her by her elbow to the kitchen, closing the door. At the mention of Matt, she burst into tears. "How did you find him? What did he say about me? About Bella?"
"He said he thought he was her father, and we're waiting for the DNA results."
"Has he got other children?"
"Yes, Dawn."
"Do they look like her?"
"Yes." She cried harder. "Come on, Dawn. We need to talk about something else Matt Evans told us. About seeing you in an online chat room."
That stopped the tears.
"Matt saw me in a chat room? I didn't see him."
"But you went in chat rooms."
"Yes, but not like the places you talked about in the trial. It wasn't nasty or about sex."
Sparks paused.
"Why didn't you say you had used chat rooms?"
Dawn reddened.
"I was embarrassed.
I never told anyone when I was doing it, because I thought people would think I used them to find sex. I didn't, Inspector Sparks. I was just lonely. It was just chatting. Stuff about what happened on EastEnders or I'm a Celebrity. I never met anyone in real life. I honestly didn't think it was worth mentioning. Sparks leaned forward to pat her hand on the kitchen table.
Did you talk about Bella in the chat room, Storm?
She looked at him and struggled to speak.
No. Well, yes, a bit. To other girls. But just, you know, stuff like if Bella had kept me up or funny things she'd done. We were just talking.
But other people can hear you, can't they?
Dawn looked like she might faint, and Sparks moved around to her side of the table, easing her chair back and gently pushing her head down into her lap for a moment. She was still deathly pale when she sat back up.
Him, you mean? She said. Did he hear me talk about Bella? Is that how he found her?
There was no need for names. They both knew who he was.
We can't be sure, Dawn, but we need you to think back, to try to remember who you talked to online. We'll look on your laptop, too.
A volunteer came in to ask Dawn a question, and seeing her tearful face, immediately started to back out.
No, please stay. Can you look after Dawn for a minute? She's had a shock and could probably do with a cup of tea.
Sparks went outside and phoned Salmond. He bagged and brought Dawn's battered computer back to HQ while his sergeant took a statement from the devastated mother. Sparks wanted to be in on the hunt through the sights. He wanted to be there when Big Bear, or whatever sick nursery illusion Taylor had used, popped up. The atmosphere in the lab was fetid, a mixture of locker room and abandoned pizzas, and the technicians looked weary as they took away the machine for cataloguing and mining. They were grateful there was a fraction of the activity to plow through this time, but it still took hours to produce a list of chatroom sites and contacts. The list, when it came, was the familiar jumble of fantasy and lurid names, and Sparks ran through them quickly to rule out the known Taylor avatars.
"He must have used another name," he told Fry.
"We got all the identities he used from his laptop, sir."
"Are we sure he only had one laptop?"
"No sign of any others, but he was definitely using at least one internet cafe. Maybe others on his travels." The technician sighed.
"We'll have to rule out all the ones we can and then narrow the field a bit."
Sparks picked up the list and headed back to Dawn Elliott's house. Dawn was still crying. Salmond was holding her hand and talking in a low voice.
"Let's carry on, Dawn. You're doing brilliantly."
She turned to Sparks.
"She's doing brilliantly, sir."
Dawn looked up at him standing in the doorway like he had the day Bella had gone. The sense of déjà vu was uncanny.
"I've got a list of the people you encountered here. Let's look at it together to see if you remember anything."
The rest of the house was silent. The volunteers had long gone, chased out by the sense of doom and Dawn's distress. She ran her finger down the names, page after page.
"I didn't know I talked to so many people," she said.
"You probably didn't, Dawn. People can just join a chat room and say hello and then listen."
She paused several times, making Sparks's pulse jump, telling Salmond some small remembered detail.
"Seagull. She lived in Brighton and wanted to know about house prices here. Billie Jean was a big Michael Jackson fan, was always telling us about him. Redhead 100 was looking for love. Wonder if she found it."
But most of the chat had been so mundane, Dawn had little recollection. When she reached TDS, she stopped.
"Tall, dark stranger. I do remember him. It made me laugh when I saw his name. Such a cliché. I think we emailed once or twice outside the chat room. There was nothing romantic. He was nice to talk to when I felt low once, but we didn't stay in touch."
Sparks went out of the room and phoned Fry. Look for TDS. Could be him. They emailed outside the chat room. Text if you find anything. It took a while, but finally, his phone beeped. Found him, was the message. One of the forensics team was waiting to see Sparks when he arrived for work.
We found the email contact between Dawn Elliott and TDS. Just three emails, but there is mention of Bella in them.
Sparks wasn't a punching-the-air kind of man, but he came close.
The next step is linking the email address to Taylor, sir.
They were also all over Dawn's Facebook site. There were hundreds of photos of Bella on it, but Dan Fry had been brought back to the team and was searching for the images available before the kidnapping and working his way through her friends list for signs of their man.
It's the new version of footslogging,
Sparks thought as he watched the team at work. A weary-looking techie came to see him later that day.
Problem, sir. Dawn Elliott didn't put any security on her Facebook page until after the little girl went missing, so anyone could have looked at her info and photos without becoming a friend.
Christ. Have we looked anyway?
Of course. Neither Glenn Taylor nor any of the identities we know about appears. Odd thing is that Jean Taylor is there. She's a friend of the Find Bella campaign.
Jean?
Are you sure it is her?
Yes,
security was put on the page by then. She not only liked the page, but she posted a couple of messages.
Messages?
Yes, she told Dawn she was praying for Bella's safe return and, later, sent a message on Bella's fourth birthday.
Sparks was mystified. Why would Jean Taylor befriend Dawn Elliott?
Are we sure it's her, not someone posing as her?
The email address is jeannie1970@hotmail.com, one she uses, and the IP address matches her area of London. We can't be rock solid, but it certainly points that way.
Sparks considered the possibilities. It could be her husband posing as her, but it was after the kidnapping. Maybe he was just making sure he heard all the info about the hunt.
Great work. Let's keep digging,
he told the technician, and closed his office door to get some thinking space. He needed to talk to Glenn and Jean, separately.
Chapter 40 The Widow Friday, January 22nd, 2010 I was doing some hand-washing in the sink when Bob Sparks knocked. I stuck my hands under the tap to rinse off the soap, and then shook them dry as I walked to the door. I wasn't expecting anyone, but Glenn had put in a little camera so we could see who was on the doorstep on a video screen. Save us wasting our time opening the door to the press, Jeannie, he said, putting the last screw in the bracket. I didn't like it. It made everyone look like criminals, all distorted, like in the back of a spoon, even his mum. But he insisted. I looked and saw D.I. Sparks, his nose filling the screen. I pressed the intercom and asked, "Who is it?" No point making it easy for him. He sort of smiled. He knew it was a game and said, "It's D.I. Bob Sparks, Mrs. Taylor. Can we have a quick word?" I opened the door and he was there, his face restored to normal proportions. A nice face, really. I didn't think I'd see you again after the compensation settlement and everything else. Well, here I am. It's been a while. How are you both? He said, bold as brass. Fine, no thanks to you. But I'm afraid Glenn isn't here, Inspector. Maybe you should call ahead next time, if you want to come back. No, that's fine. I just want to ask you a couple of questions. Me? What can you possibly have to ask me? The case against Glenn is closed. I know, but there is something I need to ask you, Jean. The intimacy of using my first name threw me off guard, and I told him to wipe his feet. When he came in, he went straight into the living room, like he was family. He sat down in his usual place, and I stood in the doorway. I wasn't going to get comfortable with him. He shouldn't have come. It wasn't right. He didn't look sorry for coming, harassing us after the courts had said it was all over. I suddenly felt frightened. Having him here was like it was starting all over again. The question starting again. And I was afraid. Afraid he'd found something new to hound us with. Jean, I want to ask you why you became Dawn Elliott's friend on Facebook. I hadn't expected that. I didn't know what to say. I'd started using the internet after Glenn was charged and taken away. I wanted to understand how it worked. Put myself in Glenn's shoes, maybe. So I bought a little laptop, and the man in the shop helped me set it up with an email address and Facebook. It took a while to get the hang of it, but I bought an idiot's guide to help me, and I had lots of time to spend figuring it out. It whiled away my evenings and was a change from the telly. I didn't tell Glenn while he was in Belmarsh. I was worried he'd think I was doing it to try to catch him out. He might think I was being disloyal. I didn't use it much anyway, and when he came out, he was surprised, but not in an angry way. I suppose there was too much going on for anything I did to matter much. But he certainly didn't know that I was a Facebook friend of Dawn's, and now Bob Sparks was here to make trouble about it. It was stupid of me. Reckless, Glenn would say if he knew. I did it one night, after I saw Dawn on the news. I just wanted to be part of the campaign to find Bella, to do something to help, because I believed she was alive. I didn't think the police would see me in the middle of all those hundreds of names. But of course, they see everything. You never think, Jean, Glenn would have said, if he were here now. I shouldn't have done it, though, because it would make the police look at us all over again. It would cause Glenn problems. Sparks was looking at me, but I decided I would say nothing and look stupid and let him blunder on. And on he went. Did you sign up to the campaign, Jean, or did someone use your identity? I supposed he meant Glenn. How would I know, Inspector Sparks? Needed to keep my distance, no first names. Where was Glenn? He said he'd only be 10 minutes. Finally I heard his key in the lock. We're in here, Glenn, I called. D.I. Sparks is here. Glenn looked in, his coat still on, and nodded to the inspector. Bob Sparks stood and went into the hall to talk to him on his own. I sat petrified that Glenn would explode about the Facebook thing. But there were no raised voices, and then I heard the door click. He's gone, Glenn said from the hall. He shouldn't have come. I told him it's police harassment, and he left. What did he say to you? Nothing. He wanted to know when you'd be back. Well, he did. I went upstairs to put my rinsed tights on the drying rack over the bath, then got my laptop out to see if I could delete myself from Bella's Facebook page. Bit pointless, really, as the police had already seen it. But Glenn hadn't. I don't think Inspector Sparks said anything to him. That was good of him. I expected he'd be back, though. Glenn was rummaging in the fridge for something to put in a sandwich when I came downstairs, and I jokily pushed him aside so I could do it for him. What do you fancy, cheese or tuna? Tuna, please. Have we got any crisps to go with it? I fixed up a plate of food with a bit of lettuce and tomato. He needed to eat more fresh veg. He was looking pasty and putting on weight with all this sitting around indoors. Where did you go? I said, as I put the plate in front of him. Just now. Glenn put on that face, the one when I'm irritating him. Down to the paper shop, Jean. Stop checking up on me. I'm just interested, that's all. How's your sandwich? Can I have a look at the paper? I forgot to buy one. Now let me eat in peace. I went off into the other room and tried not to worry, but I began thinking that it was all starting again. His nonsense. He had begun doing his disappearing act again. Not in the house, I would have known. But sometimes he'd go out for an hour or two, and would come back unable to say what he'd been doing, and would get cross if I asked too many questions. I didn't really want to know, but I needed to. If I was being honest, I'd thought that was why Bob Sparks came today. I thought Glenn had been caught doing something on a computer again. I tried so hard not to doubt him. But some days, like today, I struggled. I started imagining what could happen. No point thinking the worst, my dad would say to my mum when she got in a state. But it was hard not to. Hard when the worst is just out there. Just outside the door. I felt I should do something to stop it. If I didn't, we'd both be lost. Chapter 41. The Widow. Friday, June 11th, 2010. Tom Payne calls me back at the hotel and says the contract looks okay, but he's worried about what they'll write. It's hard to talk with Kate in the room, so I go into the bathroom for a bit of privacy. The press are not your friends, Jean, he says. They'll get the story they want to write. There is no copy control in the contract, so you've got no comeback if they twist things around. I'm concerned that you're doing this alone. Do you want me to come over? I don't want Tom there. He'll want me to change my mind. But I know what I'm doing. I'm ready. I'm fine, Tom, thanks. I'll let you know how I get on. Kate's back in my room, clutching the contract again. Come on, Jean, she says. Let's get this signed and get on with the interview. She's determined and I want to go home, so I reach for the piece of paper and sign my name on the dotted line. Kate smiles and her shoulders relax, and she sits herself down in one of the armchairs. That's the formalities out of the way, Jean, she says, and pulls a battered tape recorder out of the bottom of her handbag. You don't mind if I take the interview, she says, putting the machine in front of me. Just in case my shorthand blows up, she adds, smiling. I nod dumbly and try to sort out how to start. But I needn't have bothered. Kate's in charge. When did you first hear about Bella Elliott going missing, Jean? I'm all right on this. I think back to the day in October 2006 when the story came over the radio as I stood in the kitchen. I'd been working that morning, I tell Kate, but I'd had the afternoon off for working the Sunday morning shift. I'd just been puttering around, tidying, peeling potatoes for supper. Glenn came home for a quick cuppa, and I got ready for my class at the sports centre. I'd just got back and was putting the oven on when the news came on the radio. They said there was a massive police search for a little girl who'd gone missing in Southampton. A little girl who'd disappeared out of her garden. I felt really cold and shivery. A little girl like that. Still a baby, really. Didn't bear thinking about. I feel cold again now. It was a shock to be confronted with that little face. The eye patch and the curls. Kate is looking anxious, so I start talking again. The papers the next day were full of it. Lots of pictures and some quotes from her grandma about how sweet she was. Heartbreaking, really. We all talked about it in the salon. Everyone was upset and interested. You know how people are. And Glenn? Kate asks. What was his reaction? He was shocked about it. He'd been making a delivery in Hampshire that day. Of course, you know that. And he couldn't get over it. We both loved children. We were upset. The truth is, we didn't have much of a conversation about the disappearance, beyond what a coincidence it was that he had been in Hampshire. We had our tea on our laps while he watched the news on the telly, and then he went back upstairs to his computer. I remember I said, I hope they find that little girl Bella. And I can't remember him saying much else. I didn't think it was odd at the time. It was just Glenn being Glenn. And then the police came, Kate says, leaning forward over her notebook and looking at me intently. That must have been terrible. I give her the story about me being too shocked to speak and still standing in the hall an hour after the police left, like a statue. Did you have any doubts about him being involved, Jean? She asks. I swallow a mouthful of coffee and shake my head. I was waiting for her to ask this. It was what the police asked me over and over again, and I'd prepared my answer. How could I believe he would be involved in something as awful as that, I say. He loved children. We both did. But not in the same way, it turned out. Kate is looking at me, and I suppose I've gone quiet again. Jean, she says, what are you thinking? I want to say I'm thinking about when Glenn told me he had seen Bella, but I can't tell her that. That's too big to say. Just about things, I say, and then I add, about Glenn, and whether I knew him at all. How do you mean, Jean, she asks, and I tell her about Glenn's face that day he was arrested. His face went blank, I say. I didn't recognize him for a few seconds. It frightened me. She writes it down, glancing up to nod and look me in the eye. She lets me talk as the stuff about the pawn spills out. She sits, writing quickly in her notebook, but never taking her eyes off me, nodding, egging me on with her eyes, all sympathy and understanding. For years I accepted the blame for what Glenn did, telling myself it was my sick obsession with having a baby that made him do terrible things. But today he's not here to give me that look. I can be angry and hurt by what he did in our spare room. While I was lying in bed just across the way, he invited that filth into our house. What kind of man looks at pictures like that, Kate? I ask her. She shrugs helplessly. Her old man doesn't look at toddlers being abused. Lucky her. He told me it wasn't real, that it was women dressed up as children. But it wasn't. Not all of it, anyway. The police said it was real. Glenn said it was an addiction. He couldn't help himself. It started with normal porn, he said. I'm not sure what normal is. Are you? She shakes her head again. No, Jean. I'm not sure. Naked women, I suppose. I nod. That's what I thought. The sort of stuff you get in magazines or in adult-rated films. But this wasn't normal. He said he kept on finding new things to look at. He couldn't help himself. He said he found stuff by accident. But that isn't possible, is it? She shrugs, then shakes her head. You have to pay, I tell her. You have to put your credit card number in. Your name and address. Everything. You can't just stumble onto one of these websites. It's a deliberate act, which takes time and concentration. That's what the police witness said at his trial. And my Glenn did that, night after night, searching for worse and worse things. New pictures and videos, hundreds of them, the police said. Hundreds. You wouldn't think there were that many to look at. He told me he hated looking at them, but something in him made him look for more. He said it was a sickness. He couldn't help himself. And he blamed me. Kate looks at me, willing me to go on, and I can't stop now. He said I drove him to it. But he betrayed me. He pretended to be a normal man, going to work, having a beer with his mates, and helping with the washing up. But he turned into a monster in our spare room each night. He wasn't Glenn anymore. He was sick, not me. If he could do that, I believe he was capable of anything. I stop, shocked by the sound of my own voice. And she looks at me. She stops writing, leans forward, and puts one hand on mine. It is warm and dry, and I turn my hand over to hold it. I know how hard this must be, Jean, she says, and looks like she means it. I want to stop, but she squeezes my hand again. It's such a relief to be able to say these things, I say, and tears start. She produces a tissue, and I blow my nose hard. I keep talking as I sob. I didn't know he was doing it. I really didn't know. I would have walked out if I had. I wouldn't stay with a monster like that. But you stayed when you found out, Jean. I had to. He explained it all so I couldn't see what was right anymore. He made me feel guilty for thinking that he'd done these things. Everything was concocted by the police, or the bank, or the internet companies. And then he blamed me. He made me see it was my fault. He was so convincing when he told me things. He made me believe him, I say. And he did. But he's not here anymore to make me. And Bella? Kate asks, as I knew she would. What about Bella? Did he take her, Jean? I have gone too far to stop now. Yes, I say. I think he did. The room goes quiet and I close my eyes. Did he tell you he had taken her? What do you think he did with her, Jean? She asks. Where did he put her? Her questions are battering me, coming so fast. I can't think anymore. I mustn't say anything else or I will lose everything. I don't know, Kate, I say. The effort of stopping myself from saying any more makes me feel shaky and cold, so I wrap my arms around myself. Kate gets out of her seat, sits on the arm of my chair, and puts her arm around me. It is lovely to be held, and I feel like I did when my mum used to gather me up when I was upset. "Don't cry, chick," she'd say, and hold me so I felt safe. Nothing could touch me. Of course, it's different now. Kate Waters can't protect me from what's to come. But I sit there, with my head resting on her for a while. She starts again, quietly. "Did Glenn tell you anything about Bella, Jean, before he died?" "No," I breathe. Then there's a knock at the door. The secret signal. It must be Mick. She mutters under her breath, and I can feel she's struggling to decide whether to shout fuck off or let him in. She eases her arm out and raises her eyebrows to indicate bloody photographers, and goes to the door. The conversation between them is in fierce whispers. I catch the words, "not now," but Mick isn't going away. He says that he's got to get some photos in the can because the picture editor is going crazy. I get to my feet and go into the bathroom to pull myself together before he comes in. In the mirror I see my face, red, with my eyes swollen and puffy. "Whatever do I look like?" I say out loud. It's something I often say, pretty much every time I look in the mirror lately. I look dreadful, and nothing is going to help, so I run a bath. I can't hear what's happening in the other room until I turn off the tap. Kate is shouting. Mick is shouting. "Where is she?" he yells. "In the bloody bathroom. Where do you think, you fuckwit? We were just getting going and you had to barge in." I lie in the hotel bubbles, swishing the water around me, and think. I decide I've said as much as I'm going to. I'll sit and have my picture taken because I promised I would. But I'm going home straight afterward. A decision all on my own. "There, Glenn. Fuck off." And I smile. 15 minutes later, I come out, all pink from the heat of the bath and hair frizzy from the steam. Kate and Mick are sitting there, not looking at each other and not speaking. "Jean," Kate says, getting up quickly, "are you okay? I was worried. Didn't you hear me calling you through the door?" I feel quite sorry for her, really. I must be driving her mad, but I must think of myself. Mick attempts a friendly smile. "Jean, you look great," he lies. "Would you mind if I took some pics while the light is right?" I nod and look for my hairbrush. Kate comes over to help me and whispers, "Sorry, but it's got to be done. Promise it won't be too painful." And she squeezes my arm. We have to go outside because Mick says it will look more natural. More natural than what, I want to ask, but don't bother. Let's get it over with and then I can go home. He has me walking in the garden of the hotel, up and down, toward him and away from him. "Look into the distance, Jean," he calls, and I do. "Can you put on something else? I'm going to need some different shots." I dumbly obey, returning to the room to put on my new blue jumper and borrowing a necklace from Kate, and then coming back down the stairs. The receptionist must think I'm famous or something. I suppose I'm just about to be. Famous. When even Mick gets bored with snapping me leaning on a tree, sitting on a bench, perching on a fence, strolling down a lane. "Don't smile, Jean." We all go back inside. Kate has to start writing, she says, and Mick needs to put his photos on the computer. We stand in the corridor outside the rooms, and Kate tells me to relax for a couple of hours and charge anything I want to the room. When she disappears into her room, I go back to mine and start packing everything into a carrier bag. I'm not sure if I can keep the clothes the paper bought for me, but I'm wearing most of them, and I can't be bothered to change. Then I sit down again. For a moment, I'm no longer sure if I can leave. This is ridiculous. I'm a woman of almost 40. I can do what I want. I pick up my stuff and walk down the stairs. The receptionist is all smiles, still thinking I'm a celebrity, I suppose. I ask her to ring for a taxi to take me to the nearest station, and I sit on one of the armchairs in front of a bowl of apples. I pick one up and take a big bite out of it.
Chapter 42. The Reporter. Friday, June 11th, 2010. Kate plonked herself down at the reproduction regency desk and pushed the reproduction leather blotter aside. Her much-loved and abused